This podcast is for educational purposes only. The opinions expressed in this podcast do not reflect the official policy or position of the Ted Stevens Center, the U.S. Department of War, or the U.S. government.
In 2018, China published an Arctic policy paper stating its Arctic intentions were to understand, protect, and develop and participate in the governance of the Arctic. In the years since, it has rapidly built and deployed icebreakers to the Arctic. It has significantly deepened economic ties with Russia, buying its Arctic-based oil and gas at record rates while investing in its infrastructure and increasing northern sea route traffic. It has attempted to develop mines in Greenland, and there was speculation about establishing long-term leases of Greenlandic ports. It has expanded its presence and permitted access to other states at the Yellow River Research Station on Svalbard, and it has sought to purchase land, allegedly, across the Arctic, often negotiating with local or tribal entities to circumvent federal governments. One might be led to believe that indeed China's Arctic actions are not benevolent, but rather manifestations of its pursuit of more power and influence. Mark, how do you interpret China's Arctic actions, being someone who studies this and has followed it for years now?
Well, thank you. I would probably start off by saying that it's important to remember that China is very much a newcomer in the Arctic. It has had a very short amount of time comparatively to really understand the terrain, both literally and figuratively, to understand how policies are developing there, and to really work out an Arctic strategy. I would say that China right now has a sort of three-tiered approach to the Arctic. There's been a lot of emphasis by the Chinese government on science and scientific diplomacy, the need to develop research. The second tier has been primarily economic. China sees the Arctic as a very important place to be in regards to all kinds of different economic activities as the area opens up, everything from shipping to potentially mining. There's been fishing as well. There's been all kinds of speculation about how China's Belt and Road may move into the Arctic. And the third tier, I would say, is governance. China has styled itself as a near Arctic state, as not a country with any Arctic territory, but as a great power and potential global power, sees itself as being a very important stakeholder. So in that, China's been trying to gather more information about the Arctic, engage in Arctic diplomacy. But in many ways, it has run into trouble, especially along the lines of its relationship with Russia, which is beginning to be a bit of a concern here in Norway, as well as other parts of the Arctic.
So when the U.S. recently released its Arctic strategy, pointing out really China as a threat, it came as some surprise to some that the U.S. DoD strategy would focus that much, and we can quantify it or qualify that, but that much on China in this region, when really it's been Russia is the primary competitor or threat. The U.S. approach, focusing on China, is this warranted to the extent that that some people have pointed that out, or should China be viewed differently in this space?
Well, China, like I said, it is a newcomer. It is still very much trying to find its strategy in the region. And there is the concern on the U.S. side that as rivalries with China begin to develop elsewhere, including in the Pacific, that the Arctic will be another arena for great power rivalry. And that doesn't include just the U.S. and China, but also Russia. That said, China has not necessarily succeeded very well over the past decade in really developing an Arctic presence. 10 years ago, there was all kinds of speculation that China would be investing all over the Arctic, in Alaska and Canada and the Nordic region and Greenland. Very little of that has come about. The problem, though, is especially over the past 2 or 3 years, the relationship between China and Russia and the Arctic has intensified. And that has led to a lot of speculation, including in the United States, over whether we're going to be seeing some kind of Arctic pact, some kind of Arctic alliance between the two powers, one which could begin to push more directly on the U.S. and Western policy there. So I think that's probably making up the focus right now.
And then here I sit in Anchorage, Alaska now, on Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson. Of course, relatively speaking, I'm much closer to, say, where Russia and China have been jointly campaigning. Use the word campaigning, you could say operating, at least militarily, here off the coast of the Aleutian Islands. The last year or so, we've seen, really for the first time, and maybe even the first place, other than in some other training exercises, Russia and China jointly campaigning together. Now, some say it's maybe just military equipment operating side by side with a little bit of with little interoperability. Others, you know, actually see it maybe as more of an attempt by the Russians and the Chinese to kind of shift the playing field a little bit. Instead of the United States and in the West operating, say, in the South China Sea, it's an opportunity for Russia and China say, well, we're going to get a little bit closer to your goal line instead here, regardless of whether it's interoperable or not. What do you make of these recent actions near Alaska?
Yeah, China has become much more comfortable, as has Russia, in setting up these kinds of joint maneuvers. So there have been numerous incidents off Alaska now. There have been other examples of joint operations in the Atlantic Arctic. And that has certainly led to a lot of question over, again, whether we're going to be seeing more Sino-Russian military cooperation. I am a little bit cautious on this subject, though, because if you look at each of these incidents, they have a great deal of symbolism to them. They have a great deal of signaling to the United States that, look, we are here, the United States and NATO, they're not the only actors in the region. But how much depth there is to that, how much you can interpret that as China and Russia really beginning to cooperate, to share their defense policies in the Arctic, that needs to be looked at very carefully. On one hand, yes, we have seen more incidents off Alaska. But on the other, we've also seen a great deal of reluctance on Russia's part to allow China into other parts of the Russian Arctic. For example, near here, north of Murmansk, in the European Arctic, near the Russian border, much less evidence of Chinese cooperation there. And there was also a bit of speculation a few months back. The Chinese Coast Guard was trumpeting the fact that one of his ships got very close to the Arctic. Again, very strong symbolism, but it remains to be seen whether this is a signal of any kind of new cooperation. So I definitely urge caution in interpreting just how close this military arrangement is going to be.
And so what specifically should we be paying attention to here? Because I think you bring up some good points. I mean, sitting here in the United States and specifically Alaska, it's much more real to even people here when, you know, American citizens and then the U.S. Coast Guard's out there and they see a Russian vessel and a Chinese vessel next to each other this close to the United States. Yet you're also saying, and somebody might interpret that as, wow, Russia and China, maybe they don't have many limits. It's a no limits friendship, as was defined. But yet you're also saying that elsewhere, a little bit closer to home for Russia, perhaps the Russians are going to be more reluctant to, I guess, truly fulfill that no limits. There are limits, perhaps, is what you're saying. Is that correct? Are there kind of strings attached to this no limits friendship between Beijing and in Moscow?
Exactly. There are certainly some limits, even if you don't necessarily see them. Like if you were to only look at the governmental level, if you look at the, let's say, cocktail parties between Putin and Xi, talking about the Arctic friendships and various possibilities for Arctic cooperation, you could come to the conclusion that this is a no limits partnership. But you go down a bit deeper. Russia has, for at least a decade now, cited its Arctic as the major economic driver that is going to be the core of the Russian economy. Russia has always been very sensitive about its Arctic sovereignty and has always been very concerned about any outside power, it doesn't matter which, developing an economic or strategic foothold in the Russian Arctic. At the same time, China has been trying to walk a very fine line between, on one hand, arguing that Russia should be engaged, taking a quote unquote neutral stance on Russia's full invasion of Ukraine in 2022. But on the other hand, China's been very concerned about not doing too much, not engaging Russia too much to potentially trigger US or European sanctions. Mm. At the same time, Russia has been pushing very hard for greater energy cooperation with China, and China's been receptive to a certain degree, but there are some projects such as Power of Siberia 2, where China's been very lukewarm on. So, and at the end of the day, we are talking about two countries with potentially very different power trajectories. China is nervous about being too close to Russia, especially if Russia enters into a period of decline. Russia is very concerned that Chinese power might grow to the point where it might not necessarily need Moscow in the Arctic anymore.
So, what sort of response is Beijing and or Moscow looking to get out of these, we'll call them the military operations off the coast of the United States, notably here in Alaska? Is there a response that they're hoping to receive, and is there a response that you would recommend doing or not doing? You mentioned it was there's symbolism in this. It's signaling. What is it signaling, and what are they hoping to get out of this? I think that there's some norms and rules here, perhaps, that they're trying to poke at here. Is that fair to say?
It's fair to say, I think there are two purposes here. First of all, China has certainly not made it a secret that it is getting much more concerned about American policy in East Asia and the Pacific. Its policies towards Taiwan, its policies toward the South China Sea. So for China to begin to operate in the Arctic, especially with Russian partnership, it's sending a signal basically saying two can play at that game. The other point, though, is just the whole nature of the Arctic itself. For many decades now, especially when China was starting to put together its Arctic policy at the turn of the century, Chinese scholars, Chinese government members had always been a bit nervous about what it called the melon problem. So, in other words, if the Arctic were to be cut up, hypothetically, into eight pieces, and if you're not an Arctic state like China, you get nothing, that would certainly not serve Beijing's interests. So China is really trying to put out a signal there that, look, the Arctic is not just a giant NATO lake, that the United States should not be the only one determining Arctic policy with NATO, that China and Russia should also have a role there. So these kinds of joint operations, they very much act as an indicator to the West, to the United States, that no, we are not going to be marginalized. We are not going to be contained.
Well, you talk a little bit about the melon here, and I think a little bit what you're alluding to is that there are resources available in the Arctic that that everybody, for that matter, not just Arctic countries, might be interested in. Resources could mean shipping routes, it could mean the raw material that's in there, and as it is, here in a couple weeks, the Ted Stevens Center, along with our sister center, the Marshall Center, will be leading a side event at the Munich Security Conference that's actually focused on this particular topic. This question, I should say, is China's Arctic ambition or are its actions more focused towards realpolitik, or is it more focused on raw material? And this is probably not a binary answer, yes, no, or this or that, maybe more so a spectrum at any given time. If I interpret it and I read the policy paper from 2014 or 2018 or the years in which China has put things out, they're trying to, it seems, signal that there's a raw material interest, just like any other nation naturally would in certain areas of the world, to have material to feed populations and whatnot. Yet, and maybe in order to achieve those ends, the means might be playing a little bit of realpolitik in the partner in which China's moving out in this direction, if that indeed is correct. Is Russia, is that sort of train of thought correct when I'm trying to assess why China's active in this space and how they might be doing it?
Well, very good question. And I would say to begin with, China, so to speak, has experienced a bit of cold water on its original plans for the Arctic, especially in terms of its economic policies. When China began to articulate the Polar Silk Road, so we go back to 2017, 2018, there were really ambitious plans on Beijing's part to engage the whole of the Arctic. Obviously, Russia was going to be the major partner. No one was surprised at that. But there were very high hopes that China would be able to invest in the North American Arctic and the European Arctic, everything from infrastructure to ports to advanced shipping to potentially getting involved in mining and oil and gas. And you see the results now. The Polar Silk Road has a very limited footprint outside of Russia. So now you have China and Russia together. They are looking at each other with a little bit of trust, but not a great deal. And China now is obviously very concerned that its ability to operate within the whole of the Arctic has changed quite a bit. You have the slowdown caused by the pandemic. You have the recent expansion of NATO into the Arctic, which China has been very critical of. So now Finland and Sweden are members. And you have a great deal more American focus on the Arctic as an area of strategic competition. So this is exactly what China did not want, because this kind of scenario invites the Mellon scenario that I mentioned before, that the Arctic is going to be treated much more zero sum. And if you're not an Arctic state, you will not be in a position to gain very much. So China has had to step back, reassess the fact that although it considers the Arctic to be still be a strategic new frontier, its ability to operate freely there has changed quite a bit. So now we're definitely seeing more of a security edge to what China's been thinking about.
And so with that in mind, then what is China's next step in this manner? Is it more military operations with China? With Russia? Does it have to lean into that element because security has maybe come forward as the number one issue in the Arctic? Is that what we might expect more? Or as we were chatting beforehand here, we're speaking at the tail end of the Arctic Frontiers Conference in Norway, in which you discuss some gray zone hybrid threats. Is that something that we might expect China to enter in the space? We certainly know that Russia is active in hybrid activities across the high north. What might we expect next out of that?
Well, first and foremost, China's activities in the Arctic, its policies have certainly become much more conservative. And I think there's the understanding in China now that its abilities in the region have shrunk quite a bit. And there's a lot more daylight now between what China is able to do in the Arctic and what it wants to do. There is certainly Russia is going to continue to form a major part of Chinese Arctic policy. There's still going to be the potential for cooperation in research and potentially economically. But I don't think that Beijing has completely given up the idea that it can engage other parts of the Arctic for potential economic partnerships or infrastructure. Now, certainly the situation with Canada and Alaska, I'd say that's pretty much a closed door right now. On the other hand, though, China has still expressed a lot of interest in cooperating with the Nordic region, again, on potential infrastructure projects, even though the atmosphere there is not as warm as it used to be. China has put a great deal of emphasis now, and this has come up in some recent conferences, on developing science diplomacy. And as you pointed out, the whole issue of gray zone and narrative building. You look at the Chinese press, you look at some Chinese academic papers, there has been a marked increase in interest in science diplomacy, but it's not only a question of, okay, let's cooperate with scientists and researchers in the Nordic region, but also really pushing the idea that China is against the so-called Cold War mentality. So the narrative that it's been seeking to create in its media is that actually it is NATO's fault that the Arctic has become militarized, no mention of Russia or anything like that, that climate change has been sidelined. And that it is up to China, as well as any other regional partners, to kind of move beyond the politics, move beyond all the talk about military and strategy, and cooperate on climate change. So there's a great deal of narrative building going on, and that also has to be looked at very carefully. So you see NATO being framed as a spoiler and China being a partner. In regards to other forms of hybrid warfare, well, this is where, questions about cooperation with Russia come in, because we've had incidents, for example, involving cable cuts. We've had issues involving concerns about further sharing of information between Russia and China. This is being looked at. And we've also had some issues with dual use, concerns, for example, in Norway about China engaging in dual use scientific research, including via its icebreakers and its research areas.
There's a lot to pull out of that specifically there. I want to get to what you said though about China in its still its interest in the Nordic countries. We're talking Sweden, Finland, in Norway, in Denmark. When I think of Denmark, of course, I think of Greenland, and there's a lot of conversation about Greenland now. In my opening, I had mentioned that at least previously, a number of years ago, there were maybe hopes within China, at least for Chinese businesses, probably state-owned businesses, to develop mines in Greenland. Of course, the Greenlandic have made it known that they are pursuing more and more economic autonomy, hoping to develop more economic, more sources of revenue. turned out that the mine that the Chinese were going to back, that project didn't initiate. And of course, I talked to some speculation of perhaps Chinese looking to gain access to ports in Greenland. So with Greenland being front and center and you expressing that there's still continued interest in Chinese investment or economic cooperation with the Nordics, how do we put these two together, these two issues? Because it's hard to not take a look at Greenland now and look at it through various lenses. So how do you see this situation, Mark?
Yes, it's a very good question. I'm kind of reminded, so go back to 2013. China had just become a formal observer in the Arctic Council. And there I am walking around Copenhagen, walking around Nuuk with a notebook, trying to get a feel for what was happening with the sheer amount of speculation going on about what China was looking for in Greenland. This is where there was all kinds of talk about mining. There was all kinds of talk about China being able to develop a very strong economic foothold in Greenland and what that would mean for both Denmark and for the United States. Now, a lot of mining projects have been floated in Greenland since then, many of which had potential Chinese backers. None of these have come about, some of which have been due to budget issues, some of which have been due to political pressures. I would say that China has certainly not given up its hopes to engage Greenland more directly, but what is what's happened since then is you have Greenland now becoming much more sensitive about its potential independence from Denmark. At the moment, since 2009, the Self-Rule Act, Greenland achieved a great deal of economic autonomy, but Denmark still has oversight of Greenland's defense and its foreign policy. And Denmark has not been shy about stepping in to shield Denmark if it sees that there's the possibility of foreign interference, including from China. And there's been a few incidents where that is come up. So now you have the current situation. The debate about independence in Greenland has certainly hit the spotlight. The United States has become much more directly involved, as has Europe. And again, China's finding it very difficult to engage Greenland under these circumstances. I should point out, though, that Greenland put out a foreign policy paper, its first in quite a few years last year. And there's been a recurring theme ever since about 2019 that Greenland is not for sale, but we are open for business. So China wants to develop stronger economic relations with the United States, with Europe, but also with Canada, with East Asia, including China. Greenland really wants to become a trading power with many parts of the world. So where China is going to fit in with Greenland's move towards independence, that is being looked at very carefully, as well as the fact that it is only a matter of time before we start to see more of a Chinese military presence in the Arctic Ocean. And where is Greenland going to fit there?
And so you're speaking to us just on the tail end of the Arctic Frontiers Conference, which is a large conference held in Arctic Norway. And you were privy to many conversations, I'm sure, on this particular topic. Did anything stand out in particular, and from whom, perhaps, if you can share, if it wasn't under Chatham House rule? There's a lot of different perspectives on this issue. I'm sure some people are worried, some people are excited. What may have risen to the top? You can attribute it if you'd like, or just kind of convey some of the different points of view on the topic of Greenland.
Sure. Well, I can definitely give you some themes that came up more than once during the conversations at the conference. First of all, everyone was really happy that the weather wasn't too terrible. The previous year, we were right in the middle of a storm. A lot of our attendees couldn't get into Tromsø, so we were happy that didn't happen again. I would say that Greenland definitely was at the kind of top of the list in terms of conversations. And unlike previous conferences with Arctic Frontiers, where there was definitely much more of a discussion about the economic promise of the Arctic, a lot of discussion about climate change and how Norway was going to be addressing them, a lot of talk about the green revolution. All of those topics were still there, but last year and this year, security definitely much more visible on the agenda. Greenland was talked about extensively, the problem of developing research and the problem of dual use. Mm. And we have a very important Arctic Council meeting coming up in May. There's going to be a handover of the chairship from Norway to the Danish Kingdom. How that is going to work under current circumstances was a major talking point, as well as a lot of discussion about non-traditional security, about the problems of hybrid warfare, the problems of misinformation and disinformation, and the problems of cooperation, how we can set up cooperation to deal with cross-Arctic issues like climate change, with politics very much getting in the way.
Seems like a lot was covered, and certainly here in just a few short months, there's some irony in the in just a few years ago we watched with cautious eyes the transfer of the chairship from Russia to Norway, and now here we are with the chairship transferring from Russia to Denmark, not in a similar fashion necessarily, or not for the same reasons, but with curiosity on how that might play out, given the internal dynamics between Nuuk and in Copenhagen. Certainly it will be something to pay attention to. I want to come back to something you had mentioned about science diplomacy, and I think this is relevant in a place that's much closer to you, and that's Svalbard. And of course, we've been bouncing around a little bit in geography. We've gone from sort of the Arctic-Pacific nexus off the coast of Alaska, then back over to the Nordic part of the Arctic, and then over to Greenland. But I want to focus on Svalbard for a second. And recently, Russia invited quote-unquote friendly countries to team up for Arctic science, undoubtedly sort of a poke at the West to say, well, we're going to bring in the BRICS countries to do perhaps science diplomacy, maybe it's research, you can share more. But interestingly, one of those countries that is either interested or might be part of BRICS is Turkey, which then is part of NATO. And so suddenly here we are in an odd situation where Russia's pointing out, again, quoted, friendly countries, unquote, to participate in scientific research on Svalbard, which of course has a long story with the Spitsbergen Treaty and the rest of it. It just seems like that is science diplomacy in real time, but it's also sort of like a guise in which science diplomacy can operate, you know, in, well, these are the friendly countries and these are the not ones. And of course, some other folks would say, no, these are the friendly countries and not those ones at the same time as there's some overlap. For those who aren't familiar with Svalbard and specifically how BRICS is part of the conversation now and a little bit of the history there, I think it'd be helpful, Mark, if you kind of told us your perspective on it, where we were at and where we're headed in Svalbard.
Sure, you bring up a lot of very good points. Under the terms of the Svalbard Treaty, so more than a century ago, it was understood that Svalbard is under Norwegian sovereignty. And any other country that signs on to the treaty is permitted to engage in scientific or economic activity as long as they follow law properly. So Russia is a signatory, China's a signatory, several others have signed on. Even North Korea is a signatory. It signed on a few years ago. Several countries, including China, have scientific research stations where they engage in a variety of different areas of research, everything from biology, geology, glaciology, atmosphere. But there's the understanding that, and this was reiterated in a Norwegian policy paper last year, that certain research protocols must be followed, that if you are going to be researching on Svalbard, you should be limiting yourself to the natural sciences, to the physical sciences. This has been treated, well, it's been contested, I would say, or at least criticized by both Russia and China, who argue that this is an unfair restriction and not in the spirit of the treaty. And as you correctly noted, Russia, since last year, has been making a lot of noises towards potentially setting up an alternative research station to Nyalasund, where most of the stations are in Svalbard. Potentially even at Pyramiden, which is a Cold War era Russian settlement, very depopulated. Russia has been arguing that perhaps BRICS friends should come there. They can research whatever they want. They don't have to put up with Norwegian red tape. And it's telling, going back to the whole Russia-China dynamic, it's interesting that Russia's really been pushing the idea of, okay, we would like more friends, we'd like more BRICS friends to come join us. That to me suggests that Russia is quite nervous about being too beholden to China. So, if we can bring in more partners, so much the better. So, this is a concern for Norway. Obviously, Norway would very much like to avoid Svalbard becoming an area of strategic contestation, but Russia has been pushing very hard, kind of poking at the edges a bit. There was few incidents last year. There was cases where at Barentsburg, another Russian settlement, we see Soviet flags being hoisted. There have been incidents before of quote unquote military parades taking place in Russian settlements as a way of kind of poking at Norway a bit. And China also has been much more critical of what it sees as Norway either misinterpreting the treaty or overstepping. So the treaty has become an area of contestation, and it is obviously a concern because Svalbard is located in an area which is becoming much more strategically important, the Atlantic Arctic.
Is Svalbard something as the eyes of the world are rightfully so on the war in Ukraine, and certainly in the Middle East with ongoing conflict there, should we know more about Svalbard in this sense, where all these different actors are coming together in a place that is above 80 degrees north latitude? With given the dynamics, in an attempt here to connect some of the Arctic issues with the rest of the world, I mean, it seems to me that there's a compelling case that people should understand a little bit more about the dynamics there, seeing that there's so many international players involved and really so much at stake. Not to compare apples to apples here to say anything significant might break out there, but it seems like there's a lot of rules and norms and history on the line there on a location that most people don't know much about.
Yeah, well, back at the beginning of the last century, when the original Spitsbergen Treaty was written, certainly there was not a lot of speculation that we'd be in this situation right now. For example, the treaty itself does not discuss research activities to any great degree. Also, there's been other cases of different interpretation. For example, Norway certainly sees Svalbard as part of its under its territorial protection. Russia has been very critical of what it sees as Norway misinterpreting that to increase its own policy in Svalbard at the expense of other treaty signatories. So there's enough ambiguity within the treaty. You can pick out areas that could be contested. So what Svalbard is indicating, though, I think the biggest indicator to echo what you have said is that while Norway has really tried to stress that Svalbard specifically is about the science, that if you're going to be traveling to Svalbard, you are more than welcome to add to our scientific capabilities. You're more than welcome to do your own research on climate change, on the local environment. And trying to create a separation between the need to better understand the Arctic, this is something which pretty much every actor in this drama understands, while at the same time, the idea that the Arctic is becoming so much more securitized, that there is so much military emphasis right now. We are seeing so much increased Russian and NATO emphasis on the Arctic. Trying to keep Svalbard separated from that trend is becoming much more challenging for Norway.
Yeah, certainly something to keep an eye on here in the days and weeks and months ahead, as some of those events and activities continue. Mark, the last thing I want to ask you is maybe to help us project out a little bit into the future. I know it's a difficult ask to prognosticate a little bit, but in the United States, we tend to live within sort of 4-year election cycles. Different administrations come in, sometimes with slightly different flavors of defense and foreign policy. Certainly, we just saw a new U.S. DoD Arctic strategy released. There will likely be a new national security strategy coming out soon. Without a doubt, the Arctic will be somewhere involved within that, given all the context that we've talked about today. Yet China approaches has a different sort of strategic thinking, coming out with a series of 5-year plans, 5-year plan, 5-year plan, looking out into the future. And I think we would mention that maybe at the beginning, when China pointed out its tried to assert its reasonings for its interest in the Arctic, it may have started a little bit more of, as you kind of referred to, the melon theory of, well, there are things there that we are interested in and we might need, and we being China in this sense, need to have a say or express that desire. And then here more recently, maybe that's shifted a little bit towards the realpolitik side of it, where you have to play geopolitics in order to get what you want. 5 years from now, maybe 10 years from now, Where will China be on that spectrum, and how are they strategizing its plans for the Arctic region?
Yeah, very good question, and not an easy one to answer. In the news blog, which I edit, Over the Circle, I wrote a piece a few years back called Whose Arctic Security Is It Anyway? And it was relevant back then and certainly relevant now, because when we talk about Arctic security today, what exactly are we talking about? What is being protected? Who is being protected? And what are the nature of the threats right now? So omnipresent in all of this is the fact that climate change is still talked to basically anyone in the Arctic. Climate change is still the number one security concern in the region. We are seeing the effects of climate change quite visible, in some cases accelerating. And it has been a concern, and it's been expressed both at Arctic Frontiers and various other conferences, that with the discussion about great power rivalry, Russia, China, NATO, that issues of Arctic climate change is simply going to be pushed aside. And yet, as one Norwegian policymaker put it, the Arctic doesn't have a pause button. We can't simply allow this problem to be shoved aside for 4 years, 8 years, until the geopolitical situation improves. A lot of question as well is going to be, how is the Arctic going to be cooperating in the next few years, in the next 5, 10 years? Will the Arctic Council be able to sustain itself under a great deal of external pressure? If it is not able to reconcile differences between the major actors, if the Arctic Council is not able to function the way it has been, or it becomes, as somebody pointed out, a zombie organization, well, this is going to cause, obviously, a lot of concern about cooperation over climate change, but also very much the worry that we might be seeing a balkanized Arctic, that the Arctic might begin to fall apart. We'll see different constellations or different rival organizations. And this will not only complicate issues that are of mutual concern, not only climate change, but regional development, but will also really make the Arctic well and truly a strategic arena. And it's widely understood this is not going to serve the interests of the people in the Arctic, the 4 million odd people who live in the Arctic, including indigenous populations, who are very concerned that a lot of decisions are being made in faraway capitals.
Dr. Mark Letang, thanks for taking the time to be with us today. We'll have you back here in a few months to chat about it again. Thanks for the time, and we'll see you somewhere in the Arctic sometime soon.
Great. Thank you very much.